So tonight, as the first week of the new year, I thought it might be nice to revisit a little bit the core teachings of the Buddhist path, a little bit of a twist maybe. And again, apologies for this cold. I think if I go slowly, I might be able to make it through. The Four Noble Truths. Any of your basic books in Buddhism, you'll be able to read through material on the Four Noble Truths. And now, of course, if you Google Four Noble Truths, you'll get more than you ever wanted or needed. But I take some inspiration first here from the Dalai Lama and then from some other resources. To look at them from the question of why are these fundamental, why are they so important? And then I'd also like to lead us in the direction of the cultivation of wisdom and how the cultivation of wisdom relates to the opening of the heart and the healing of the heart. So we'll see if I can somehow get us there. I also, you may remember, usually don't rely on written notes very much, but since my mind is mush, I think I better do this to make it worth your while being here. So the Dalai Lama has suggested that in order to see the importance of the Four Noble Truths and why the Buddha taught them, it's helpful to relate them to our own lives and to our own experience. And I like that because already he invites us to explore and examine. So we can see that these core, the heart of the Buddhist teaching, it's not like a revealed, declared truth, declared religion, declared belief system at all, but rather an invitation to explore with certain requirements or caveats that we're not going to be able to see what we need to see clearly if we only rely on the mind. So we need some training to build concentration, to shift our perception so that we can see things in a slightly different way, in a way that's not apparent to the everyday mental processes. But in terms of taking a look at our own experience and then the value of the Four Noble Truths in that, what we see just through really ordinary knowing and observing is that all beings, not just human beings, but really all beings, are moving toward, they desire happiness and want to be freed from suffering or overcome suffering. It's an instinctive thing. We can see this quite clearly. We don't need to have a proof for it. Beings aspire toward happiness, and suffering is something that everybody wishes to avoid if possible. There's also a sense of that we have the right to aspire toward happiness and to avoid suffering. So there's a little bit of Buddhist Bill of Rights here in this core teaching and in the Four Noble Truths itself. But then, of course, the obvious question is, how do we go about doing this? Because it's clear from observing our own experience with the human race and our knowledge of history, there has not been such a great success on this point, achieving happiness and avoiding suffering. The desire has been there, but this is what the Buddha saw and understood in his quest, in his meditation, and then finally when he awoke under the Bodhi tree, rose from his enlightenment experience, thanked the tree, and then went out to teach. The first teaching that he gave was these Four Noble Truths. We don't know how to do it. We just don't know how to do it. But what he discovered is there is a way. There is a way. First, we need to understand how suffering occurs, how to, if it's possible, to end suffering, and then how to go about it. In the heart of this, there's something that is important for us to be aware of, as particularly as practitioners, so that we know why we're doing what we're doing, so that we know why we come together on Tuesday nights and sit and then do our loving kindness, and why we struggle to do it at home again and again. And so what we want to see in the heart of this is that events, any events that occur, and particularly happiness and suffering, have or are in relation to a pairing set of two events, causes and effects. And this is why some people like the Dalai Lama will say, actually, you know, Buddhism is more of a science of mind or a philosophy rather than a religious belief system, because we're actually aiming our attention to be able to observe causes and effects. We have suffering, but from what the Buddha saw and what people continue to see as they observe this is that suffering doesn't come from nowhere. Just it arises due to certain causes and conditions. And that happiness also arises from a particular set of causes and conditions. So then knowing this, we see that what our path is, what our work is to discover the causes and conditions that give rise to suffering and let go of them, and the causes and conditions that give rise to happiness and cultivate them. So it's very logical, scientific, phenomenological. That's really at the heart of these practices and of our path. We also just have to mention that when, in the Buddhist tradition, when we speak of happiness, there is, of course, relative world happiness, and relative world happiness certainly has causes and conditions. But then also at the heart of this teaching, there is a kind of an absolute happiness, sometimes referred to as that vague and too often used word, enlightenment. Or maybe we could use, there are many words, you could use the word cessation. What is it cessation of? It's this complete and entire cessation of suffering. So by definition, happiness, complete happiness, would be the complete and entire cessation of suffering. and what we understand, but what it takes both practice, study, and then ultimately it's beyond all that to understand that the deepest, most profound, most complete cessation is actually an experience that is out of the conditioned world. So, and we just don't worry about this, but just to say for further exploration down the road, since enlightenment cessation, this experience, well, it's even called the unconditioned, the experience of the unconditioned. So since it is actually outside of conditioned reality, we can't talk about those particular causes and conditions. But what we're going to, what we do talk about with our practice and our description of the path and so forth, they also, they have a list, you know, called the seven factors of enlightenment. And all these causes and conditions are sort of on, in the neighborhood, the suburbs, right on the edge of enlightenment. And we can cultivate those, and we can actually understand them and see them clearly, though they'll get more and more subtle as we move along the path. And then there's something else that happens that once, but we can at least understand that in order to get somewhere, you've got to get in the neighborhood. And if we, by the time one gets in the neighborhood, say within 10 moments, one knows how to finally release into the unconditioned, just actually a moment of complete letting go of everything, even all causes and conditions. But, you know, when you're in that neighborhood, you'll be okay. You won't need an instruction book. But meantime, to get to the neighborhood, we want to understand the causes and conditions that have, do, and will give rise to suffering, and the causes and conditions that have, do, and will give rise to happiness. And so this is what the Four Noble Truths are actually about. They're distinguishing and telling us which causes and conditions give rise to happiness and which give rise to suffering. So that's just, I think it's really key, important to know that about the Four Noble Truths. And then we read them as a list, and we read them in all kinds of different descriptions and ways of speaking of them. But I would, and I would suggest that take those lists as an invitation to both experience and reflection, and knowing that actually this funny practice that we do, which is, as we always say, simple but not easy, about gathering attention, bringing it to some present moment anchor, say the breath sensations, and learning to let go of thinking, to let go of dwelling and thinking, and to experience more and more awareness in a moment of now without thinking, and strengthening this, struggling to strengthen this, cultivating this again and again, has tremendous power. And what it can take us to is the ability to see what is described in the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths is a list and a description of what we will actually experience over time as a result of the various heart core practices that we do. Cultivation of attention, mindfulness, awareness, and then also the opening of the heart. So one statement of the First Noble Truth, one wording of it, is unsatisfactoriness and suffering exist and are universally experienced. There is suffering It is universal. So to live as a sentient being means to suffer. This is because this world, described the word as samsara, is not inherently perfect. It isn't. And we will, by virtue of having been born, will inevitably endure various kinds of suffering, at the very least, sickness, old age, and death, the loss of those we love, loss in general. That's inherent in the situation. There is no permanence here, no solidity here. Everything will change. Everything changes all the time. That's just the way it is. But we can understand the cause of that suffering, and that's so that we don't fall over into nihilism, or, of course, my own personal favorite in high school. It was just slightly before Beatnik, on the verge of Beatnik, and so forth, where we all dressed in black, existentialism, basically suicidal moroseness. So when you see that first truth, the first insight, it's all suffering, that's the danger. You can fall off the edge over there into that sort of thing. But the teachings save us. They saved me, certainly. I'm sure many in the room would raise their hand. Because we can understand the cause of that suffering, and then we can engage in the possibility of freedom from it. So the second noble truth is that clinging, attachment, is the cause of that suffering. And it's the attachment to things that are transient. We keep trying to grab things that just dissolve. We don't understand that this is all impermanent, so we keep trying to find a permanence, and that trying, that craving, that clinging, that attachment even causes more suffering. We look for a permanent self, which is like Santa Claus. It never was there. Never was there. So that's the cause. There is suffering. It does have a cause. And then the third truth is that there is the possibility to end this experience of unsatisfactoriness and suffering. And this can be attained through the cessation of craving. Complete cessation of craving is complete end of suffering. But fortunately for us, there's a neighborhood. And on the way, we can let go of suffering in a moment. We can learn how to let go of that craving. We can release that attachment. And so, great news, okay, not so depressed anymore. But then the question becomes how, and that's the fourth noble truth. How do we do this? And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. So it's like asking for directions. All right, how do I do it? Okay, here it is, 1 through 8. That there actually is a path, that it is a gradual path, that it has 8 steps, and that it can lead us to actually complete cessation of suffering, but in the meantime also gradual letting go of suffering. Quite wonderful. So then we learn to study, practice, engage in the path. So I'm going to read you just a quick summary, and then again you'll have a lot you can study and read, and you've had discussions and classes, and we'll continue to have those about this path. It's translated initially, every one of the eight steps starts with the word right. People have objected to that. It said it's maybe not a bad, that's maybe a bad translation in English. So we might say wise instead of the word right or skillful. But to say it, right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So that's quick summary. Those are the eight things. Then vast way of exploring, practicing, and looking at each of those eight, cultivating each of those eight. But that just that summary list, it's kind of nice to have it in our minds. Right understanding. Sometimes that's called right view, right perspective. The second one is right thought. Sometimes it's called right intention or right resolve. Again, you could use the word skillful, you could use the word wise. Right speech, two words, endless practice. Right speech, daunting, but we progress, we work. Right action can also sometimes, right conduct, right action, wise conduct, that's nice, isn't it? Right action, wise conduct. Right livelihood, right effort, sometimes they say wise endeavor, right mindfulness, right concentration. So that's our eightfold path. These are the instructions. The goal, happiness, freedom from suffering, the outline, Four Noble Truths, the instructions, eightfold path. So then, where I'd like to take us tonight is just at that first step. The first step on the Eightfold Path is called right understanding, or we might say wise understanding, or even true understanding, or sometimes wisdom. That might be another word to use, wisdom. So we can see that cultivating wisdom, learning what it is and cultivating it, is right at the beginning and all through the spiritual path. It's the cultivation of wisdom, the practice and learning, understanding of wisdom. What is wise and skillful, and what is unwise and not skillful. Again, what actually leads to happiness and what leads to suffering. Again, our mistaken perception, as we all know from our own experience, from history and everything, is that if we get everything we like and want, we will be happy. And if we get rid of everything we don't like and everyone we don't like, we will be happy. And again, we're invited to just look. Does that work? That's the instinct, that's the habit we try, but does it work? Has it ever worked? Apparently, if we have the gift of the paparazzi, so we know what's going on in the lives of all the wealthy people. And so it does seem that having enough money to get everything you want doesn't bring happiness. Although we're still convinced if we won the lottery, we could, you know. But it seems that the only happy, wealthy people are the ones who are giving it away as fast as they get it. They're quite happy. So that's a good thing to see and to know, this generosity of heart, dana paramita. We've been studying the paramitas, generosity, care and compassion. So also looking at, from our 21st century view of history of the world? Did any country ever become happy by trying to get rid of everyone they didn't like? This apparently does not work. It only leads to the possibility of blowing up the entire planet. So it's funny, you know, in our own, it's the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Anyway, these truths self-evident. We hold these truths to be self-evident. It's self-evident that somehow this mistaken perception that going after everything we want and pushing away everything we don't want will make us happy. It doesn't work. We're required to keep seeing that. Our meditation allows us the opportunity to keep seeing that again and again, because apparently we can't just be told or convinced, because we keep doing it, don't we? When our meditation, we want to be more comfortable. We want the body to be more comfortable. We want it to be quiet. If there's a noisy environment, we decide that it should be a quieter environment, and we should try to find that, because our meditation really requires quiet. No. I remember, you've heard me, some of you tell this story, the Committee for the Quiet Meditation. When I was in graduate school in San Francisco, at the what was then the California Institute of Asian Studies, it's now the California Institute of Integral Studies, but we were in a little building back then, the top of Dolores Hill, and Rena Sirkar, the Burmese nun who teaches there, was living there. And so we could have a sitting group every morning with her, those of us who lived in the neighborhood. So we did. She was my first Theravada teacher. And she had a quality, the way she taught us was by sort of narrating what our experience might be while we're sitting. It's a pretty unique way to teach, and it was very effective. So we had all, in our beginner's idiocy, had decided that we needed a quiet meditation, and there were a lot of noise things. So we had a committee, and my assignment, because I worked in the front office, was to put all the phones on hold. The old days, the old phones. Those of you who are younger may not know of these things, this arcane thing. But so I'd put all the phone lines on hold, so not the phones would ring, so forth. So Rena saw us doing this, you know. She let it go for a while. And then one day, we're sitting, and the neighbor house owned a motorcycle. So in the middle of the meditation, the motorcycle guy gets on his motorcycle and roars and revs and so forth, and then roars off. And she's sitting there, and again, she interjects in the meditation. So she said, "We notice the loud motorcycle noises. We're upset. We don't want noise for our meditation. We think our meditation should be quiet. Now we are really angry. Now we are forming a committee." So she said that, and that's exactly what happened. We were a smaller group, much smaller group, but we all laughed, and that was it. That was the end of the Committee for Quiet Meditation. So we all began to understand that it doesn't have to do with what's out there. It has to do with what's going on in here. And then, in fact, if you have a noisy meditation situation, it's actually a great gift. Early on, when I was in the Insight Meditation Correspondence course, I corresponded with some prisoners. And the description of life in a prison, there's a wide range of horrible suffering, but the noise, everybody's got something going with audio, TV, and all of that, and people are yelling, and these are, buildings made a lot of metal and so forth. So Just to be able to meditate in that situation meant those guys could meditate anywhere. And there were some women, those people could meditate anywhere. So it seems like a challenging and difficult environment, but actually, boy, talk about building strength for practice. So wisdom, cultivating wisdom through our practice. And then a particular aspect, there's going to be many aspects if you're doing this study, have class going on with this, many aspects of right understanding, of cultivating wisdom. But tonight, to continue, I'd like to move in the direction of cultivating wisdom in its aspect of compassion and kindness and loving kindness. If we realize that, again, right understanding, that the way we understand the world is how we will actually experience it, that our experience comes from the way we understand the world, then we can also begin to see that if our understanding, our concept, our belief is that we are isolated, separate, individual, unconnected, then the experience we will have due to that belief, that understanding, is an experience that will feel alienated, isolated, separate. And those feelings create suffering. They just do. Alienation does not give rise to happiness. We can experiment with that in our meditation. We can observe, we can watch. What feelings give rise to happiness? What feelings give rise to suffering? Just experiment. See for yourself. It's really interesting. Find out what feelings. And certainly alienation and separation give rise to suffering. But when we begin to understand, to have an understanding of reality that it sees that there is actually really no separation, and that we begin to experience this thing called interconnectedness, we also notice that that feeling of interconnectedness gives rise to feelings of happiness. We see it happening. So, Thich Nhat Hanh, Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, said a little something that is relevant here. Letting go does not mean abandoning one thing in order to seek something else. It means giving up every comparison, seeing that there is nothing to be removed and nothing to be added, and that the boundary between ourselves and others is not real. We need not give up our human condition in order to become a Buddha. We seek Buddhahood in our very human condition, giving up nothing and seeking nothing. That is the meaning of aparinihita, translated as aimlessness, which is sometimes translated as wishlessness. So what he's implying here is that in our very human condition, once we begin to be able to see it as it is, we begin to actually feel this interconnectedness. We begin to experience the falling away of boundaries. that were constructed by the mind, by perception, misperceptions, by beliefs, by ideas, by an incorrect understanding of the way things actually are, that led to suffering. And as we can let go of that little by little by little, we see that the way things actually are allows us to have an experience of interconnectedness, of love, of loving kindness, of compassion, caring, connection that gives rise to happiness. It's due to the way things actually are. So letting go of misperception, letting go of misunderstanding, little by little takes us to where we already are, oddly enough. So our path, our practice path, gives us techniques and skills to cultivate awareness, mindfulness, whatever we want to call that. And this tradition has a wide range of techniques that offers us, that are offered to us to train in these skills. The first thing we do is we train attention. We have to train attention in general because we are so, our minds in their habitual patterns are so distracted. Some of us have a discipline, a gift in our work and our creativity that has trained a lot of attention, and so those that have that are very fortunate. But whether we have that basis or not, we can still, with our meditation techniques and practices, proceed with training attention. Then, now I'm going to move more in the direction of working with emotion and cultivating loving kindness and compassion. So the second thing that we do after we've trained attention, basic meditation techniques, practices, mindfulness of breath, whatever, we start to use that attention to look more and more carefully at what the mind does habitually, and we begin to see thoughts and emotions much more clearly. We're training ourselves away from dwelling in the content, the storyline. Most of our lives before practice and decades after too, we dwell a lot in the content of thoughts and the content of emotions, and so we can't really see them clearly. It's like Google Earth. Man, if you've never seen that, get a friend to show you that. You can get these now, of course, these just aerial views of not only just countries. You know, we used to have maps that people drew, but now we've got satellite views. But cities, neighborhoods, you know, if you've never seen your own old neighborhood where you grew up, Google Earth, get somebody to show you. It's fun. I once could not find an office I had to get to in Tacoma. So I just kept taking the wrong exit from the freeway and doing circles. I'd be back on the freeway. So finally I got somebody to do get it on the Google Earth so I could see, and I visually saw the turn. So why I bring this up, you may wonder, sometimes I wonder, is because if you're inside it, you can't see it. So our habit is to be inside the story, inside the emotion, inside the thoughts, inside the melodrama, all about me, usually I'm the star. But if you're inside of it, you can't see it. But our meditation practice, little by little, lets us see thoughts themselves and even start categorizing them. Oh, this is planning, this is worrying, this is remembering. Emotions. This is loving, this is hating, and so forth. And then finally, and this is the very big deal. First, before that, not only we see emotions, we also begin to see what reactivity is. We see how emotions can be tremendously reactive. We can see that our stories are tremendously reactive. So that's the next piece that we want to see. And then finally, or next, nothing is finally until everything is finally. But next, we learn to actually sit with, that's the terminology in the biz, sit with difficult emotions or painful memories. You've noticed that, haven't you? If you've been on retreat, you really notice it. After the first few days, the body quiets down and we're not struggling with pain, and suddenly difficult memories arise. Again, often we think we're doing something wrong, or if we could only concentrate, this wouldn't be happening. But actually, this is a wonderful, wonderful gift, because we are learning, we are developing the ability to be in balanced awareness in the presence of pain and suffering arising from within, difficult memories, difficult emotions. And that is the beginning of the cultivation and strengthening of equanimity, balance of heart and mind. So the experience, the sensations, the memories, the thoughts are unpleasant. But rather than our habitually conditioned reactivity, trying to push away and get rid of the unpleasant, we begin to be able to sit with it with balance and equanimity. We realize that it all arises and passes away, and that we don't have to react, we don't have to be dragged around by reactivity, but that we find peace in the heart of difficulty with the strength and ability of equanimity. This helps us let go of suffering. So we see that as an aspect of letting go of suffering. Then the next thing that can happen is that we can begin to see the situation of what one of my Tibetan teachers, Sony Rinpoche, calls wounded love, the reality of the wounded heart. We truly, truly see and experience the woundedness, painful emotions, and we begin to be able, or not to be able, we begin to be motivated in the direction of healing that woundedness. And then we see that once again our tradition can respond to that with a variety of well-tested and effective, successful techniques for healing the woundedness and for cultivating a heart of happiness, a heart that is free, more free of suffering, less weighed down with suffering. And it's so interesting that the techniques, again, some of them are simple though not easy. Many of them, most of them, are simple though not easy. We want complex. We like complex. We think way too much. So it's kind of astounding. It's astonishing how some of these techniques are so simple, though not easy. So one, for example, the reason I really love the Burmese-style technique of focusing your attention when we're doing basic meditation, at the rising and falling in the lower abdomen, those sensations. Until, of course, with concentration, the sensations disappear. We move our attention to other things, choiceless awareness, awareness itself, Rigpa, if you're in Dzogchen. But starting as our basis, the lower abdomen, the Tibetan tradition points out when we're caught in reactivity, when the emotions are dramatic, when we're really suffering a lot in the mind and the reaction, they have a whole way of looking at the body energies. And they say that that condition, the lung energy, nothing to do with lungs, an energy called the lung, has risen way up into the head. And so people are just way off balance. There's tremendous reaction, emotion, and so forth. And then they have a whole group of practices to bring the lung down. But this simple Burmese style of focusing your meditation in the lower abdomen will just do that naturally over time. So I like that. So simple. Just using that. So you might, if you don't use that, experiment with that focal point, anchor for your meditation, and see if over time it doesn't sort of allow you more equanimity in general. Then, of course, we have our practices of loving kindness. And seeing this woundedness, really experiencing it, can really be the motivation to try and work with the techniques of loving kindness, the Brahmavihara techniques, which again are fairly simple. Once we can talk ourselves into actually doing them and practicing them. The cultivation of loving kindness, beginning by first actually experiencing it, the way to do it, find a benefactor. Benefactor is some being you have such a connection with that when you think of them, loving kindness comes. So then think of them. Spend some time so you're literally soaked in the feeling, so you know the feeling. Just like learning to sing or to play an instrument, you have to be able to hear the notes and then reproduce them. So the techniques of loving kindness, just step by step by step. Do this. In addition, while you're doing that, we also know that the mind just talks endlessly. So the loving kindness practice says, okay, we're in the relative world. We're not fully enlightened, so let's just use that. If the mind's going to talk endlessly, let's just choose what it says. So we choose phrases of loving kindness, you know, may all beings be happy and so forth. And then we put it in there. Mind wanders off, we bring it back. We reprogram the tape. Then there are other, even more enriching techniques, for example, which, again, this is such an amazing tradition. The Abhidhamma teachings, Buddhist psychology, show us, that through years of experiment and knowing that the cause that gives rise to loving kindness is seeing goodness. We needed 5 more minutes. So, cause is seeing goodness, then see goodness. So actually turn it into a technique. Allow yourself to list the goodness of others, to list the goodness of yourself, again and again and again, and it will give rise to loving kindness. It works. We just have to do it. We've been given these astounding techniques. All right, I have to wind up because my throat has abandoned ship. Strengthening of loving kindness then naturally gives rise to compassion. Little bit at first, and then once again we get the interest and we begin to explore and we see that we're given wonderful techniques to cultivate compassion as well. We begin to feel what it actually feels like to feel compassion for ourselves and for others. And once we feel that, we realize that it brings happiness. Compassion gives rise to a feeling of happiness. Jealousy, rigidity, vindictiveness, non-forgiving, even pity isn't happy. Compassion gives rise to happiness. So we begin to see the direction. What will actually bring us happiness? It's kind of a wonderful thing. It's not a grit your teeth and do good because it's the good thing to do. It's a different path altogether. It's beginning to see that goodness gives rise to happiness. And way back at the beginning, wasn't that it? Didn't we want to be happy? So now we're learning how to be happy. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I recently had a fit of self-pity. I was just on my case. I'm a really good practitioner, and I'm not so good at kind of a lot of regular stuff. I'm also a fairly good vegetarian cook, for retreats anyway, sort of country cooking. But there's a lot of ordinary world stuff that I am so not good at. My office looks like an explosion in a paper factory. So I was really like on my case, you know. And first it was self-pity. But luckily, since I had some mindfulness developed, awareness, I became aware of it. So I was watching it, and of course, pity is actually the opposite of compassion, but I wasn't quite there yet. So I was seeing the self-pity, and then I got mad at myself, so then I was angry at myself, and then I saw the self-judgment. So then it was self-judgment, anger, and self-pity. A soup. And then I saw the desire for perfection. And then, so I'm getting to the edge of the mess. The desire for the perfection, and I say, I remember what Sharon once said to us when we were in the staff room. It's samsara, it's not supposed to work. So I realized I was trying to get out of something I couldn't get out of, and then I was angry because I couldn't, and so the circle. So then I remembered, pity is the opposite of compassion. And it was this wonderful feeling. I can't tell you, this great feeling when I just let it go and gave rise to compassion for myself. I cared about myself. I cared about the pain. And I sort of surrounded it with some comfort, you know, which is a different flavor than pity, than self-pity. And so why I tell this to you is because when you actually feel it and taste it and watch it happen and experience that shift, let yourself. And then you really realize, this is the way out. This is letting go of suffering. Compassion was there and the suffering went away. And then there was just kind of a sense of humor about it. This is samsara. This is where we are. Nothing works. We have this idea that if we're just good enough or practice hard enough or something, we'll be able to make this perfect. But that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is we'll let go of our reactivity to the imperfection of this. We'll be able to let go of our reactivity to the weirdness of this. And instead, we'll achieve some equanimity. My Tibetan teacher says equipoise. Nice, equipoise. Some strength of heart. The heart will open. We'll see that kindness and compassion are a real release. And we'll be able to let it go. We'll be able to let go of suffering. And then as Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho always remind us, let go, let go, let go. If you let go of a little, if we let go of a little, we will have a little peace. If we let go of a lot, we will have a lot of peace. And if we let go completely, we will have complete peace. So let's sit together for a minute. At the turn of the year, a great opportunity for enormous letting go. Some of you are quite young, but I have 59 years of letting go. I can do. So we let it go. Just arriving in the here and the now, completely free, completely at peace. May all beings be free of suffering. May all beings find peace.